Hello, everyone. My name is Amy G, and I am grateful recovered compulsive eater, bulimic anorexic from Maryland. And it is so awesome to be here. What a privilege and an honor to share my story, talk about the principles. You all have had such an awesome convention. I just, hats off to everybody who organized. You guys are really top notch. And it's been such a pleasure to listen to the speakers. And, it was really great. So, and to me, it's always an honor and a privilege to share my story because I am a miracle of this program. There is no doubt in my mind that I would be dead if it was not for this program. I am a miracle of transformation through the power of these 12 steps, these principles, this fellowship, the tools, all of it. I am who I am today because of my higher power and this program. I am, without a shadow of a doubt, a bottle in the bag, living underneath the bridge, compulsive eater. I've run the full gambit of this disease. Just to qualify a little bit, since you can't see me from the neck up or whatever, my top weight was pushing 200. I stopped getting on the scale at about 160, 170. And then I had, the three D's of the disease: denial, delusion, and defiance. And I just said, well, I'm just not going to get on the scale anymore. And then my lowest weight on my anorexic side, I was 102. I know that number for sure. Driving in the car in the summer with the heat on and the jacket on and all of that. About 5'7" and a half, used to be 5'8". I'm kind of shrinking in my age here. That's kind of freaky. And my worst manifestation of this disease, though, was bulimia. That is a scary manifestation of this disease. So I've run the full gambit. I'm also, an alcoholic and a drug addict. I mean, can you catch my drift here? If it anesthetized my feelings in any way, I was all in, stop the world. I wanted to get off. I didn't want to have to feel. I didn't know what I had for a long, long time. Now, then I came into this program in my first OA meeting was March of 83. And then I spent almost 5 years. I love sayings and slogans. Don't walk out 5 minutes before the miracle. I spent almost 5 years in Overeaters Anonymous suffering the torture of relapse because I was unwilling to work this program as it's laid out. Finally, when the pain of where you are gets bad enough, and December 7th of 1983, I'm going to date myself here, Pearl Harbor Day. I like to say the ships were sunk and so was I, and I finally surrendered to this recovery program. So that's been some 33 years, a lot of one day at a time. I'm really nothing special. My sponsor used to say, if I can do it, you can do it. It's just the 12 steps. The one who got up earliest this morning is the one who has the most abstinence because it's a one day at a time program. And I believe that in my heart of hearts. It talks about it in the big book, and I'm an unabashed big book thumper. I believe that if you take out alcohol and alcoholism and put in food and compulsive eater, you describe me to a T. And it talks about it on page 17, that's the chapter, There Is a Solution. It says, we have a common solution upon which we can absolutely agree and join in brotherly and harmonious action. And when we say common, it means to me, there's no secret code. It's just the instructions. It's the 12 steps. And that's what I did. And that's how I recovered. And if I can do it, certainly anybody else out there could do it as well. It's just one day at a time. I do have some pictures, so I wanted to throw up some pictures just to give you some ideas. I kind of feel like a picture say 1,000 words. So again, none of these are at my top weight. So whoever has the pictures, if they could just put them up one at a time, I think I put them in order. Okay, so here's me. I'm about, 13 or 14. And this is me not at my top weight. I cut off the picture of my brother there on purpose. My brother was a very good looking young man. And I used to think that everyone would look at my brothers and sisters who were all popular and look at me and say, what happened to you? Next picture. I don't know about you all, but did you all think that somehow there's like an instruction manual to life and somehow you missed it? Because I certainly felt that way. One of my favorite readings in some of our literature, it says, it describes me to a T. It says, I felt like there must be some secret to happiness, something that everybody else knows and that I'm supposed to know as well. And if I could just figure it out, I would feel great about my life. But no matter how hard I try, I just couldn't figure out the answer. Sometimes I felt like something was missing, like something was wrong with me. And that's what I felt like. Is there an instruction manual out there? Because even back then, I felt like a dis-ease living in my own skin. And I didn't understand. And even back then, and this is my senior prom, even back then, I thought food was a comfort to me. I mean, I had no clue about the twofold nature of this illness, the physical allergy, the mental obsession. All I knew is that food did something for me. It gave me a sense of comfort. This is my senior prom, just to give you an idea of what that disease has done to me. That was probably a year later, the senior prom picture. And I dieted on amphetamines, diet pills, and the liquid protein diet back then. And I starved myself for almost 3 weeks so that I could ask this guy to the prom that I'd had a crush on for almost 2 years. And I remember how excited I was to finally fit into that outfit. And then I went to the prom and I wound up binging and purging. I was full into my bulimia at that point, getting so wasted that I blacked out. I don't remember my prom. And I woke up at this guy's house on the floor while he was making out with my best friend. That was what this disease would do to me. You know, I didn't understand how it was wrapped around my throat and that I was using the only instruction manual that I had for coping with life, which was filling the hole in my soul with a knife and a fork. And I didn't know. You know, by then as a teenager, I was introduced to bulimia. You know, I thought it was the magic trick, stick your finger down your throat and you can eat whatever you want. But this disease is so cunning and so baffling that what used to be where I would binge to the point of feeling full up to here and not be able to get another bite in and pass out. Instead, I would go ahead and stick my finger down my throat so that I could continue to eat. So what was just one binge turned out to be these massive binges of 24, 48 to 72 hour binges by the time I was a freshman in college. And you can put on a lot of weight when that happens. But anyways, if you go to the next picture, I'll show a couple other pictures here. There's a third one to show you my anorexic phase. You know, to me, I bought what the world that the myth sells you, that thin is well. So I decided I was going to go on a diet. And, you know, by then I'd been on hundreds of diets, right? And I'd been addicted to amphetamines and all sorts of things. And at some point, you know, my family's motto was, all it takes is a little willpower. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can do anything you put your mind to. And I started dieting with a vengeance. For those of you on the anorexic side or the anorexic tendencies, the high that comes from that control is really something. And I kept losing weight and I kept losing weight. And then by the time I was 17 and 18, I did what any insecure anorexic would do is I tried modeling. And I'm telling you what, talk about never being good enough, never feeling right. Everything I did was wrong, was never pretty enough. I was never thin enough. And I continued to get thinner and thinner and thinner. And I got really sick. So I crashed and burned, and I really had no idea what I was up against. And having learned now and looking back, you know, I was powerless before I was 18. I was powerless because I didn't understand I was dealing with the twofold nature of this illness, a physical allergy and a mental obsession. When I put sugar, high fat, flour, wheat, and volume, that's a big one for me, into my body, I triggered an allergy. And to me, the allergy is the phenomenon of more, the craving for more. I couldn't stop. And I didn't know that that's what the problem. I thought everything was externals. I thought if my family wasn't screwed up, or if I could just get that guy I had a crush on, or if I could just meet the magic numbers on the scale, that somehow my life was going to come together like some fairy tale. I didn't know that when I ingested those substances, it created that phenomenon of craving. And that physical reaction where I had to have more and more and I couldn't stop. And then even the greater aspect of the disease was the mental obsession. It talks about it in the AA 12 and 12. We've warped our minds with such an obsession for destructive, in my case, eating, that only an act of providence, for me, the 12 steps, can relieve me of that insanity. My life was completely obsessed with weights, calories, scales, for the bulimic volume, what order to eat the food in, what bathroom to go find, and then how to exercise it all off. It was crazy. It was insane. And I just thought, I didn't have enough willpower. This disease ravages us emotionally, spiritually, and physically. I hated myself. By the time I was a freshman in college, I'd broken the knuckles in my hands twice by punching bed frames and looking at myself in the mirror and with such self-hatred punching the mirror because I didn't understand why I couldn't stay on a diet. I tried many geographical cures. One of them is I went to Norway as an exchange student my junior year in high school. Gratefully, it got me away from the drugs, but they drink like fish there and they eat four main meals instead of three. My parents didn't see me for an entire year. I came back. I took an airplane flight, and of course I had to sit next to another alcoholic. We are like magnets to each other. We got drunk on the plane. He threw up on my white pants, and I got off that plane. My parents hadn't seen me for a year. I was 50 pounds heavier with vomit on my pants and couldn't talk straight. My mother's jaw dropped to the floor. I wanted a hole to open up and just die right there on the spot. You see, I grew up a diplomat's child. I was made in Taiwan. We lived overseas, spent a lot of time out of the country. My parents used to do a lot of entertaining. And I kid you not, again, dating myself, I'm the youngest of four. She would do all these entertaining and these parties, and she would have her four children line up like the sound of music at these parties. And we had to introduce ourselves. And you had to pull me out from underneath the bed because I didn't want to do it. Remember that kid that didn't feel like she had an instruction manual and who hated herself and couldn't live in her own skin? And all she wanted to do was have the maids and servants make the cookies so she could get home after school and binge her brains out. That was a girl that needed to introduce herself to hundreds of people at a party. I didn't want to do that, right? But my parents said to me, "You represent the United States of America. Act like it. I'm 7 years old." You know what I mean? Like, what the hell does that mean? You know, and this is not to blame my family. Nobody threw me down and, no one tied me up and threw food down my throat. I did that to me. That was my response to life. That was my instruction manual. I didn't have any other. But then again, the sayings in the room is that, 98% of the families in the world are dysfunctional and the other 2% are lying. You know what I mean? What is to define functional? And I'm not minimizing severe stuff that can happen, severe dysfunction, overt and abuse versus, but my family was just my family. And we had our dysfunctions. And one of those was where I never felt good enough. I was in a no talk, no feel family. My parents didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. And my response to life, my only way of coping was to find a way to anesthetize myself. When we came back to the United States, I was 11 years old and I wasn't heavy. I was not a heavy child, actually. But we had swum on a national swim team in the Dominican Republic, and I had green hair. I was pigeon-toed, knock-kneed, had braces, and had just shot up in height. So I was a foot taller than everybody in my class. To say I was not comfortable in my skin at that point would have been an understatement. And what did I look for? I looked for the comfort of food. Even back then, my elementary school and my middle school were in walking distance of my house. I used to skip out at lunch and go get my binge foods at home and purge and then go back out and go back to school. I got a hold of smoking pot and boy, did that mess up my eating. Whatever eating habits I had back then went out the window when I started to get a hold of the pot because then you got the munchies and I started blowing up in weight. And that was the first time that I ever really couldn't control my weight. And I started going up and down the roller coaster. Even with the bulimia, you can consume massive amounts of calories, puke them up, but not puke them all up. And I used to do that horrifically, 10, 12 times a day. At the bottom of my purging, I couldn't keep anything in my stomach anymore. My bottom, basically, when I graduated, I went to look for a little of Norway because I was an exchange student there for a year. So I went to St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, looking for a little in Norway there. And that was the height of my bottom, if you will, and my bulimia. When we talk about the principles, one of them, obviously, the first one is honesty. Talk about honesty. I didn't know what I didn't know. I couldn't have been honest with myself because I didn't know. And if I think about my disease of compulsive eating, you take those principles, and it was the reverse. I had the reverse principles of all of them. By the time I was a, you know, this freshman in college, we talk about the principles of honesty and of integrity and willingness and faith. I had no faith. I had no willingness. Integrity, I was a liar and a thief. My roommate in college, she had what they call an HTH, which is a hometown honey. And she used to go home every weekend. And I would take the money that my parents gave me for books and whatever incidentals. And I used to go to the grocery store with my fake party list, right? And I'd pretend that I was going to have a party, and I'd buy bags of groceries. And then I'd go back to my dorm room, and I would take a trash can, and I'd put a large green garbage bag in it, lock the door, and proceed to binge and purge all weekend long in that trash bag while reading Harlequin romances and things like that. You know, I wanted to die. I wanted to die. And I'll never forget. And this isn't to gross you all out. This is just to say, this is, you know, this disease, I used to go to an OA meeting where the guy would say, this disease wants you dead, DEA dead, but it'd be happy to take you on the suicide layaway plan, you know? And that's what this disease does and did to me. And I had no clue. I had no clue what was going on, but I still was sticking my finger down my throat. And one day I took that bag, I carried it out, I threw it in one of those big garbage, you know, bin things, and I missed, and it hit the cement and then spurted out everywhere. And of course, this caused a huge commotion because someone found it and they went knocking door to door of this dorm room asking, are you the bulimic? You know, like, yeah, like someone would say yes. But I remember them knocking on my door, and I could feel the blood rise up to my face of the shame that I felt, because what happened to my willpower? What was wrong with me? Why was I so awful? I didn't understand why I could not control or stay on a diet. I could start a bazillion diets, but I could never stay stopped from the compulsive eating. Of course, they never found out who it was. And going back and making that amends, I will tell you, back then, that was a tremendous thing when I finally did get down to the business of working this program. But anyways, I digress. So I was going to binge, and there was a sign on the wall on my way to the cafeteria one day at this school, and it said an Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And I can be honest with you, if I had known what I was really getting into, I probably would have run the hell in the other direction. To me, I just thought I just needed another diet. You know what I mean? I had no idea, right? But I didn't know what else to do. So I went to this Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And I can tell you, for the first time in my life, you know, this is a disease that tells you, you don't have a disease. You can start on Monday. It wants to get up in your head, isolate you, and tell you you're the only one that does this crazy shit. But for the first time in my life, I found identification and I found hope. Talk about hope, a principle of hope. The fellowship, God with skin on, I like to say it, my higher power. The power of the rooms and of a meeting and hearing your story. You know, I heard people talking about doing things with food that I had never imagined anyone else had done, like taking food and putting it in a trash can and then going back a day later, an hour later, a week later, and getting that food, eating food that was burned, frozen, stolen. Those were all the things that I did, stealing money so that you could go buy the food, which is what I did as well. And I thought, oh my gosh, could this be me? I'd never heard the word compulsive eater before. You know, I'm 18 years old. I had no clue. And I thought, oh my gosh, could this be where I need to be? And then you mentioned God, and uh-oh, there became the problem. You know, that principle of faith, well, I had none. My family was, it was all about you, yourself, and you, me, myself, and I. Intellect was king, and you had to do it all yourself. And so I got up in the middle of that meeting, talk about drama. You all knew why I got up, right? And I walked out of that room in a huff, and because I was so devastated. And thank God, you all, and this is the power of these rooms, someone followed me out of that meeting. And she didn't try to convince me that there was a God or talk to me about higher power. All she said to me was, look, Amy, you are welcome here. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop being crazy with food. This is an open meeting. You are welcome. And she handed me something called the 15 Questions of Overeaters Anonymous. Now, this is in 1983. We still have this. It's a pamphlet. We have it. And it's 15 questions, things like, Do I eat when I'm not hungry or not eat when my body needs nourishment? Do I go on eating binges for no apparent reason, sometimes eating until I'm stuffed or even feel sick? Do I have feelings of guilt, shame, or embarrassment about my weight or the way I eat? Do I eat sensibly in front of others and then make up for it when I'm alone? Yeah, like a bulimic. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, there's 15 questions here. I answered yes to every single one of them. Trust me, this was the only A I had gotten an exam in a really long time because I was failing because I wasn't even going to class at that point. I had been a straight A student and now I was failing everything at the altar of this compulsive eating. It was like a splash of cold water on my face. I thought, oh my gosh, this is me. This must be me. I don't know about the God thing, right? But I'm coming back. And that's what I did. We say, you know, keep coming back. But we also say it works if you work it. And there I ran into another problem. And this is where I talk about those 5 years, almost 5 years in Overeaters Anonymous, the torture and the hell. I thought I had met hell and torture with my compulsive eating before I came to program. But what happened is I came to program. And after every binge, I would think, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Because you see, I couldn't stay abstinent. I was all about what it talks about on page 59 in the chapter, How It Works, in the big book. Half measures avail us nothing, you know? And that's what I did. I did half measures. At some of these steps, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. Oh boy, did I ever balk. And I struggled tremendously with that agnosticism. I struggled with all of those principles, honesty, integrity, self-discipline. I didn't have any self-discipline. I wanted to be struck abstinent. My first person that I asked to be my sponsor was literally someone who had binged and then she walked up the stairs and the lights flickered and she'd been abstinent ever since. And I'm like, dang, I'll take that, right? Again, there was a lot more to her story, but that's the only thing I heard because I wanted that kind of recovery. I wanted recovery on no effort and no work on my part. You know, they say OA is like the mafia. Once you get in, you never get out, and it ruins all your binges because you know too much. And that's what happened for almost 5 years for me in OA. You know, pain of discipline or pain of regret. I hung in there and I kept coming back. Like they said, don't walk out 5 minutes before the miracle. But it was torturous because, again, I kept thinking this whole idea about willpower. Because you see, I was very happy to admit and honest about I'm a compulsive eater. I'm a bulimic. I am powerless. My life is unmanageable. By that time, I had moved back to Maryland and I was going to school in Maryland, still struggling with this whole idea of abstinence. But what I didn't understand was that I willpower, even the knowledge that I had now in OA, and even the experience that I had was not enough to combat this disease because me, myself, and I, and my thinking always brought me back to the food. Remember that comment about my mind being warped because of this mental obsession? My best idea always brought me back to thinking, regardless of all the consequences, regardless of the circumstances, that putting those binge foods in my mouth was the best idea I had all day. I mean, how many times did you all find yourself standing in front of a refrigerator, 5 bites into a binge, going, how the hell did I get here? I didn't understand that my willpower and my knowledge was not sufficient, even with what I knew in Overeaters Anonymous, to combat this disease. I had to struggle with that idea of powerlessness and a higher power. And finally, on December 7th, you know, I look back and I can honestly say God was working for me, my higher power, when I didn't see it and I didn't know it. And that's one of the ways to cultivate even today the idea, the spiritual principle of hope. Because if I just need hope, all I need to do is look back to cultivate some gratitude and I have hope because I can see in my journey where higher power carried me where I could not on my own. By then, I had figured I was one of those, quote, constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves, that I was worse than all of you all, and that therefore I had failed Overeaters Anonymous. I couldn't be honest, and I might as well die. I wanted to die, and I thank God I just didn't have the guts to do it because I contemplated it. Again, those breaking the knuckles in my hands and things like that, there were times in that end stage bulimia My finger was not enough. So I took dull knives, ladles, and spoons, stick down my throat. And there were times, folks, that I just wanted to stick that knife in my heart because I wanted to die. And I didn't understand why I could not, even with what I knew, I could not stop and finally surrendered. And I thought, you know, oh my gosh, I can't go to OA anymore. And at that point, I didn't have a car. I wasn't driving and I had stopped going to meetings. And, you know, meeting makers make it, folks. I realize that we have to work these steps. It's called the 12-step fellowship, but the recovery to me is in these rooms. And when I stop going to meetings and I stop engaging with my fellowship, I put myself in a world of hurt and trouble because then I'm left with my own thinking and I start becoming very selfish and self-centered. And that's exactly what happened. And I remember thinking, you know what, I can't go to OA anymore. It's not going to work for me. And I heard about some new meetings that cropped up in my area. And I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I'll go. But you know what? It's not nearby. It won't be. There's only one of those meetings. And they talk about weighing and measuring and all this kind of stuff. And it must be crazy. It's nowhere near me, blah, blah, blah. And all of this. Finally, and I like to think it's divine intervention, I decided to take a look and find out and pick up the phone and find out where that meeting was. And I kid you not, and it brings me to tears to think about it now. I kid you not, there was one meeting in the Maryland, Virginia, and DC area. That meeting was in walking distance of my house, walking distance. So I went to that meeting and for the first time in my life, and I actually saw someone there that I hadn't seen in a couple of years. And she had light shining in her eyes. And for those of you who know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. They not only talked the talk, they walked the walk, and they had a look in their eyes that said the food was no longer calling them. You know, when I say I'm recovered since December 7th of 1987, I say that because my definition of abstinence, and actually I didn't make it up, it's OA, it's refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working towards or maintaining a healthy weight. And I like to add, while doing so happily. Never in my wildest imagining that I would have a life beyond this constant obsession with food, weights, calories, scales. It was on my mind constantly. And this person had a look in her eyes that said, this doesn't happen to me anymore. And I wanted what she had. And I'll be honest with you, if she had told me you needed to climb backwards in PJs and pigtails digging to China, you know, I would have done it because that's where the disease had taken me. And I wanted freedom. And I didn't care what she said. I wanted to be free of what this disease was doing to me. And I was finally willing to follow the instructions in totality. It says, we stand at the turning point, and here are the steps we take with complete abandon, page 59 or 60, and how it works. And I was at complete abandon. And one of the things, you know, when I talk about digging to China, was the weighing and measuring thing. You know, some of us need to do that. At least I do. Some of us don't. Some of us can define whatever their abstinence is. I can't define that for you. But I can tell you, for me, the beginning of my true recovery was step zero, which was having a food plan that has a line in the sand about what my abstinence is and isn't. I needed a line in the sand. And I needed to understand that I couldn't have my allergic ingredients in that food plan. And I needed them to be weighed and measured because of the volume issue for me. I could be triggered just as much on volume as I could as sugar, high fat, and flour. So I needed to know where my meals started and stopped. You know, in AA, we put the plug in the jug. In OA, I needed to know what jug to put that plug in. Abstinence is not everything, but I needed to know what that is. I mean, I can be stark raving abstinent. I did that plenty of times in OA prior, right? But I need to be abstinence in order to work the tools of the program, the handrails going up the steps while I'm working the steps, right? So step zero, put the food down. I had to get a food plan. I had to get a sponsor. I had to get a food plan and I had to get a home group. I had to go to meetings and I had to start understanding truly what it meant to work these steps. You know, we talk about the principles of honesty and willingness and self-discipline and perseverance. You know, anyone who says this program doesn't take work is just like, you know, full of shit. Excuse my French. You know, I had to understand that there was work to be done and I had to be willing to follow those instructions. That whole thing with agnosticism, I struggled tremendously with that. What do you mean? I don't want the God I grew up with. That was a Zeus-like character. It wanted to zap me with a lightning bolt whenever I went the wrong way. I didn't want that kind of God. And my sponsor, God bless her, you know, they say love and tolerance is our code. I must have driven you all crazy those first couple of years. I was so whacked out. But you all were so loving and so patient. She said, Amy, look, we're going to fire that old God, okay? It says God of your understanding. And I don't care if you think it's Jesus, Buddha, or the universal vibes of a tree, as long as it isn't you and it's greater than you, and that we can get on with the business of working these steps, and your higher power, trust me, will evolve. I mean, I loved your keynote speaker on Friday night talking about this evolution. And for me, it was also an evolution. To me, willingness, the principle of willingness, it's the principle of action, which is mean I was going to act my way by working these 12 steps. You know, we act our way into a new way of thinking and believing. I don't think my way into recovery. I act my way. I take a leap of faith. I become willing and I take those action steps. And she was right. As I began to work the steps, I began to recover. They talk about steps 1 through 3, we get to know our higher power. 4 through 7, we get to know ourselves. 8 through 9, we get to know others. And 10, 11, and 12, we continue to get to know God, ourselves, and others. And when I got to the inventory of steps and understanding that willingness, that action, and that integrity, I started to understand that that instruction manual that I grew up with, it was killing me. I had old ideas, old beliefs, and ways of thinking that were causing me. They may have helped me survive when I was a kid, but they were now killing me. And I had to learn how to change that beliefs, those lies that I were believing. Things like, you had to be perfect to feel safe, control the world, or you'll be vulnerable. Thin as well. Just get married, that'll fix everything. I mean, those were things that I had to grow up and learn. I was 22 when I came to this program. To say I had a crash course on learning how to grow up. I remember, I think it was Eric was talking about his not getting in relationships. I think it was the Saturday keynote for the first year. I had my sponsor and my therapist begging me to not be in any relationships for my first year so that I could honor myself and my program. Because I'll tell you, I was not having relationships prior to program. I was taking hostages, okay? I did not know how to have relationships. My own relationship prior to program was with an inanimate object called food, right? Or drugs or alcohol. You know, I wasn't just all of a sudden going to be struck abstinent and recovered in my thinking. That's what the 12 steps were for, was to start changing my thinking. The big book talks about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. And I had to be humble. And then we talk about one of those spiritual principles. I had to be humble enough to say, the way I learned, the way I coped, the way I was thinking was not going to help me anymore. And I started to understand my thinking and what was behind the ism, you know, the inside me stuff that was going on. And then with steps 6 and 7, again, a continued inventory on self, not to beat myself up, but to understand that my MO was all about me, myself, and I. And that I had to start looking outside of myself. My sponsor already had me giving service and out there and looking outside of myself. And I will tell you, by the time I got to step 9, I mean, there were people on that list that I said, you know, like when hell freaking freezes over, right? I had a brother that was abusive physically and emotionally to me. And I said, there's no way in hell, you know, but there were amends to be made. And I can tell you that is truly when I started to see clearly God working in my life, that I now choose to call my higher power God in a way that I never dreamed possible. There were amends that went ways I could have never imagined. I remember one time, and again, God doing for me what I could not do for myself. I remember once I got this great idea in my head that I would make amends to this gas station. I used to work in college at this gas station at Maryland, and I used to work the 24-hour, the night shift, and I would take money, steal money from the cash register and go to the candy machines and binge all night long, stealing and going to the candy machine. And when it came to make financial amends, I thought, oh, I got this one. I'm going to make financial amends anonymously. And I decided to mail a check anonymously. Hello. And as I'm walking to the mailbox and I'm about to put it in the mailbox, you know, something struck my mind going, you know, maybe you should talk to your sponsor about this. You know, aren't you supposed to work with your sponsor about these amends? So thank God I never mailed that check, right? I did actually wind up making amends. I physically walked into that gas station to make the amends, fearing prosecution. But at that point, it meant more to me to grow and not be in disease. Because they did say, if you don't make those amends, man, the chances are, if you don't clean up the wreckage of the past, the chances are very good that I cannot stay recovered and abstinent. So I did it. And guess what? I wasn't prosecuted. I was forgiven. And I had an incredible conversation with a man that it was just incredible. It was totally God. It was totally God. I did wind up making amends with my brother for my part. I didn't make amends for my abuse. Of course not. That's not what amends are about. But I was able to have a conversation with him that I now have a relationship with my brother, which I never dreamed possible. I mean, that for me was God showing up for me. At that point, these principles were rolling along in ways that were showing me that there was a new way of life that I wanted, right? I all of a sudden was starting to like myself. I could live in my own skin. You know, how did that happen? It was by the transformation of these steps. And I can tell you, what is it like now? I mean, I told you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Now I live in 10, 11, and 12, where I continue in step 10 about me. I improve my relationship with my higher power, and I practice these principles. That's what it says. Step 12, practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's what I do. I work these 12 steps. I know Bill kind of like interchanged, you know, steps with principles here. And I love the idea of the one word equivalent with each step. But for me, if I'm working a step, I mean, I like to keep things simple. If I'm working a step, then I'm certainly, you know, working a principle, right? And I will tell you the two, I mean, I'm not going to go through, I mean, Eric did a great job going through the principles one at a time, but I can tell you for me, you know, one of the questions that was asked of him was what was his favorite principles or the ones he liked the most. And for me, the two most important principles to me for working my recovery program that are standout, I mean, they're all important, but to me was first one was humility. You know, everything predicated for me at step one was to admit my powerlessness and that I could not fix myself. It takes tremendous humility and courage to do that, right? Because I had to make a choice finally to believe that I was powerless. It talks about it on page 25 in the big book. There was no middle of the road solution. We were either going to go back. You know what? I'm not going to butcher this. Let me read it. It says here, if you're a seriously alcoholic or compulsive overeater as we were, we believe there was no middle of the road solution. We are in a position where life was becoming impossible and we had passed through the region from which there was no return from human aid. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other was to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. So to me, humility was everything. Because if I don't have humility, even today, then I start to rely on myself. Self-sufficiency is very deadly for me. Because if I have no humility, then I'm blocking the sunlight of the spirit and the power that I need from my higher power to recover and stay sane every day. So no humility, no God. No God, no power. No power, no recovery for me. The second one for me It's love. I had to learn how to love myself. OA says, don't worry, we'll love you until you can love yourself. And you all showed me that. And now with service, I turn around and I give that love back, and I can never give enough love, you know? And in my work, in my relationship with others, because humility is about me, love is about others. You know, today I'm working on my 10 step on a daily basis. And one of the things that I think about is how can I show love to others? For example, when I'm really pissed off at someone, I take a pause and I think, is what I'm saying going to be loving? Is it going to show love to others by speaking what I'm going to say? I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. Just in case anyone thinks I'm all that because I have 33 years, I am not all that. This recovery is one day at a time. The big book talks about our recovery is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Trust me, that can wax or wane depending on what principles or steps I'm working on a daily basis. And I'll tell you, I did a 10th step. I'm not kidding you, 5 minutes before this meeting started, because I was pissed off about my husband using the leaf blower outside of the room where I'm going to be speaking. And it pissed me off because it was so loud. And he's out there doing that work because we're having guests over, and he's cleaning it because I asked him to. But now it's pissing me off because I'm trying to prepare for my talk here. So I went outside in a huff, right? And I didn't think about what would be loving. And I said, can you cut it out? It's driving me crazy, right? And he's like, why can't you go to another room? I'm just doing the backside. And I'm like, well, I don't want to. It's driving me crazy, right? So I walk back up here and I sit down because I wanted to meditate, right? Talk about improve our conscious contact for a few minutes. And as I quieted my brain, it struck me that that was not showing love, and that my lie that I was believing was that somehow my life was supposed to be more important, and my schedule was supposed to be more important than what he was doing. And that was not showing love and kindness to him. So I went back down there and I said, you know what? You're right. And the other thing, ego, was that it didn't occur to me to go to another room. And he was right. So I went back down there and I said, you know what? I'm sorry. It didn't occur to me to go to another room. And I didn't think of that myself. Thank you for what you're doing to clean up the house for the guests that we're having coming over. I'm sorry. And I went back up here, and all of a sudden I was at peace. You know, that's how love and humility works in my life, because I'm willing. I don't always do it perfectly. I would love to do what they call the three R's in Al-Anon. I'm also in Al-Anon, which is refrain, reflect, and respond before speaking. The triple R's, they call it. You know, I want to respond to life now. I don't want to react. And the only way I do that now is by working these principles of this program. And if I can do it, you can do it. I just want to wrap up by saying there's a bunch of stories in the big book. And one of my favorites is called Me, an Alcoholic, because to me, the power is in these rooms. You know, I don't work this program perfectly, but I do have a way out now. I have now become equipped. You know, a lot of stuff happens in these last years that I've been blessed to be recovered. And everything, there hasn't been one person who hasn't gone through it that can show me the way. My higher power has never let me down. You know, life still hits hard, and I have to learn to accept it the way it is and rely on my higher power and these 12 steps, and they've never let me down. Okay, so I'm just going to wrap up with this. Here, I found an ingredient that had been lacking in any other effort I had made to save myself. Here was power. Here was the power to live to the end of any given day, power to have courage to face the next day, power to have friends, power to help people, power to be sane, power to stay sober or abstinent. Moreover, I am deeply convinced that so long as I continue to strive in my bumbling way toward these principles I encountered earlier in the chapters of this book, this remarkable power will continue to flow through me. What is this power? With my AA and OA friends, all I can say that it is a power greater than myself. And if pressed, I can say with the psalmist who said long before me, be still and know that I am God. With that, I will pass. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Amy. That was a wonderful, wonderful share. We're now going to open the floor for questions.
Also, Marie, just so you know, there were there were two charts or a PDF that had a chart. And then there was a prayers, you know, for meditation and step 11 work. And so if you ever get them and you want to post them or you figure out, because I thought they were kind of cool. So I wanted to share them with you all. So FYI.
Okay. Thank you. And if someone finds it, would you let me know? The first question I have for you is, what were the three R's for Al-Anon?
Oh, refrain, reflect, and respond. I ask for supernatural pause and to be able, when I am irritated, when I want to jump in, when I want to react, when someone isn't doing what I want them to do, when I am angry, is to pause and think.
Okay, the next one. Thank you. Love so much of your share. I'm adding while doing so happily to my definition of abstinence. There too, with all my sponsees, current and future. If I can do it, you can do it. Can you please speak more to balancing service and self-care?
Oh, awesome. Awesome question. There is a balance there, and that has changed over the years. I mean, I was a single girl in my 20s when I first came to program, and I dove into service headlong because someone said, nothing ensures immunity from relapse but service. So get in there and do it. And my sponsor, and I still do it today with my sponsees, is I have them commit to a service position, whatever that is, even if they're not recovered, it's go to meetings, you know, open, put out, well, it used to be put up chairs or, you know, set up the tea or call a newcomer. And I dove in, I just dove in. And then when I got married and started having kids, I had to find that balance that y'all are talking about. And that's kind of a moving target, sort of, you know, write a book about balance and we could all make $1 million, right? Because we're all searching for that magic balance. But I will tell you that if I had the proverbial shopping bag and I had to put in the rocks to fill, you know, or whatever to fill it, the biggest thing would have to be my recovery. Because that has to come first. It is my oxygen mask. And for me, it's a way to self-care. And it doesn't mean I don't work with my family around what I need to do for my program. I don't expect them to understand, but I do expect them to work with me. And that's how I self-care. I set appropriate boundaries where I have to, which is around my service and the work I need to do for program, right? Which is I have sponsee calls in the morning. I have meetings that I go to. I have prayer and meditation times. Those are just non-negotiables. I don't walk into restaurants without reading menus. I don't go to parties without knowing what food is there and bringing mine if I don't have it. Those are non-negotiables. But that doesn't mean that I can't be flexible with my service and flexible in other areas when it comes to needing to be at something for my kids when they are in school. I mean, I'm an empty nester now, but needing to show up for them and then balance work. And that was something that I had to work on with my sponsor. I mean, again, I said fellowship, God with skin on, higher power. I asked you all, how do I be a better mother? How do I show a better sex and love ideal? Please show me the way. So I asked questions. When we talk about the principle of humility, when even as a sponsor, three very important words is, I don't know. Let me get back to you, you know, is to ask others for help and showing me the way. What step do I need to work that will help me get rid of this resentment? Because my husband asked me to change a couple of my sponsee calls. Do I really want to change them? Can I change them? Or do I need to stick with that, you know, or can I be flexible? I don't work this program on my own. I don't sponsor on my own. I use the program in every way, shape, or form to find that balance. And as the target moves, to readjust those balances, to fine tune. I don't know about you all. I don't deal with change very well, but I'm learning how to one day at a time with this program. I hope that helps.
Can you repeat the three D's, denial, delusion, and...
Oh, absolutely. So the three D's of the disease, denial, delusion, defiance, and you finally come to the program when you're dying, desperate, and doomed. The other three D's. And that was me.
I like that. Thank you so much for your talk. I love so much of what you said. Do you give your sponsees a meal plan, encourage them to work with a dietitian or use the OA dignity of choice? In other words, how do you help the sponsee get abstinence with the meal plan?
Well, first off, absolutely. I am not a doctor, dietitian, or nutritionist. I don't give out food plans. That's, for me, a tradition breaker. And that's not what OA does. OA worked long and hard for a dignity of choice, and I respect that. So if I have someone that's new, you know, we can work with the dignity of choice for a while, but ultimately I am going to say, whatever plan you come up with, we need to work together to make sure it has none of your allergic substances, right? And if you don't know what those are, we'll work with that. And I'll ask questions like, what's the food that you binge on the most? And usually it has sugar in it, I would say 99% of the time. So maybe if it's not food groups, we have to drill down to ingredients. I basically say, look, I'm going to be in your face about this, because without step zero, I mean, to me, working these steps while you're eating is like saying you're a little bit pregnant. You know, it's like, you know, I'm either clear-headed and out of the fog of the eating, and you know what I mean? Or I'm binging my brains out. To me, there's no middle of the road, right? I need that clear line in the sand. So whatever we work together on and figure out what those ingredients are, and then I say, go take it to a dietitian or a nutritionist, because I don't know your age. I don't know your health conditions. I'm not a doctor, but I want to get approval from someone who is a professional. And OA recommends that as well, even with the dignity of choice, to go out there and make sure that it is something that will work with your age, your body, your bone structure, your lifestyle, all of that. And it has worked. I've worked with diabetics. I've worked with people that eat six times a day, people that eat three meals a day, two meals a day, you know what I mean? But they know what is abstinence. And once that's done, that only takes a little while. Boom, we're getting onto the business of working these 12 steps. Because I don't know about you all, I stayed stop a lot of times, but I could not stay stop because to me, abstinence was not enough. I had to deal with what was going on inside of me, right? And I could not do that without the transformative process of these 12 steps. So yeah, we get started with the meal plan, we get an agreement and a buy-in from a professional, and then we're moving along, right? We're moving along to the steps.
Thank you. The leaf blower incident was exactly like things I go through daily. Can you explain more about keeping one's mouth shut in the pause?
Well, remember in step 12, it says we practice these principles. You know, there's no graduating. There's no perfection. We claim spiritual progress instead of spiritual perfection, the big book talks about. And what I will find is that when I do practice it, even if it's after the fact, you know, that's what's so great about these steps. You know, some days I will think of this before I open my mouth. Other days it'll happen while I'm in the middle of talking to my husband or one of my kids, for example. And I'll be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm saying this. It's so wrong. And sometimes I'll shut up and I'll say, I'm sorry. Or sometimes I'll need to walk away and say, you know what? I can't finish this conversation right now. I need to walk away and get myself straight. Other times it'll be after the fact, like my leaf blower incident, right? Because I was stressed. I do know that when I'm stressed, I don't think well. I do know when I'm indulging in the halts, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, the chances of me pausing before I speak are probably nil and none, right? So the tools are very valuable. OA has tools for a reason. Remember I said, you know, walking up the guardrails of the steps, those are the tools, my guardrails. Those are really important, those tools. And I know for me that if I'm too hungry, angry, lonely, tired, you know, the chances are I'm going to react to life instead of refraining and then responding or even reflecting. So for me, it's about practice. I don't do it perfectly, but I can learn and I can grow and I can do it better. I may take three steps forward, one step back, and then take another step forward. But who cares? As long as I'm progressing. My feeling is you can only coast downhill in this program. I'm going to keep moving forward. I'm going to fall forward, right? And do the best that I can and learn from you all. I'll pick up the phone and I'll say, you know what? I don't think I did this right, sponsor. And she'll say, well, do you need a 10 step? And I'm like, oh, where was I? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? Okay. Check, check, check. You know, what was I believing? What was the lie that I was believing in? What, that my kids have to follow my agenda, my schedule, or I have a right to get angry at them? No. So it's a process. And again, I talked about the principle of love. Many times I'm saying to sponsees beating themselves up about doing it again, right? I did it again. Oops, I did it again. Is to practice the principle of love. And I say, go gently with yourself here. What's awesome about this is you're willing to make a change. You're aware that you need to make a change, and you accept that you won't do it perfectly. But you know what? Suit up and show up and let's try again. It is a WE program. We don't do this alone. You have a higher power. Your higher power is going to help you do this better. Trust me, if I can do it, you can do it.
When do you want these documented?
Well, just throw up the chart real quick. I actually meant to show this in case you're a newcomer out there. You know, I had such a struggle with that decision and that admission of powerlessness. And to me, I saw this at a convention I was at, and I just thought that it clarified so well what it is that I needed to do, because only I am powerless, but only I can choose to make the decision to admit powerlessness. It's a choice. So if my step one is there's a problem, I have to make that decision that I have the twofold nature. Thank God I know who I am today. I'm a compulsive eater. I'm an anorexic. I'm a bulimic. And I have the twofold nature of this illness. So if I have that problem and I lack the power, then I need a solution. So there it is, the fellowship, the spiritual nature of finding a higher power, whatever that higher power is, that's my solution. Need to plug into the power. Step three, I have to make a decision. I have to be willing to take action. Am I going to take action and believe this program works, or am I not going to believe? And to me, I just thought that was really simple. So I just wanted to lay it out there.
Okay. Was there a second one?
There was. It was just prayers, like I said, that helped me, you know, in the morning on awakening, and then in the evening, what I do on retiring, just some of the principles that I use. But I was hoping there might be a way it could be just, you know, given or, you know, if anybody wanted it. But you know what I can do is I will put my phone number out there, or I'll put it with my name, and feel free to text me. And I'd be happy.
It's on the screen now. It's called the Prayer Guidelines.
Right. So you can text me and I'll send it to you. I don't want to waste, you know, the time or take away from questions. But this is just what I do for my 11-step work to improve on a daily basis. I have these prayers, so I thought I would share them. That's all.
Thank you. Could you please speak more about handling difficulties in abstinence, bigger than the momentary brood to your husband, momentary lapse there? I've experienced horror and rejection within OA when I've had personal problems. Well, long-term abstinent. I don't think we talk about being fallible and sometimes really making things difficult for ourselves or others. I can come up with an example of that. I'm an incest survivor, and that's something that's very difficult for other people to even hear anything about. And when I was doing some work on that, I struggled with staying abstinent. This is not my question, but I know that there were a couple of people that said, just get over it, you know, my struggle. So there wasn't compassion and love, or there wasn't anything like, take it easy on yourself and take it slow. That's the only example I could come up with that might reflect what the question is.
Sure. I always feel like it's important, especially because if there's a newcomer, because our primary purpose is to carry the message to the still suffering compulsive reader, to share what it was like, what happened, and then, you know, whatever is left at that time to share what it's like now. I mean, I can't compress 33 years in an hour. You want to give me another hour, I'd be happy to. But the reality is, there's no guarantee that life, just because I'm recovered, that life isn't going to hit. And trust me, in these 33 years, I have dealt with my fair share of tragedy. You mentioned the incest thing, and I think it's important. You know, we have to deal with the things that happen. And I, you know, I dealt with not one, but two date rapes, and I had to work through those issues in early recovery in order to be free to have healthy relationships. And I will also say that my sponsor, because, you know, those three words, I don't know, you know, she said, you know, you might want to look for outside counsel, because I don't have a depth of knowledge to help you with this. And I was in so much pain because I wasn't anesthetizing myself anymore with food. And I did have a relationship. This was about 5 or 6 years in when this stuff came up. And I think it's important for us to recognize that, you know, there's things that I'm just a sponsor, and I'm not a therapist. And so it was recommended for me to bring alongside my OA and 12-step program, to bring alongside a therapeutic environment for those really deep traumas. And I'm so glad she did, because I think she saved my life in doing that. because I needed to process that. I will say that there were other things that I dealt with the 12 steps and my higher power that were incredible that I never thought I would have gotten through. I went through a period where I injured my back and I was really laid flat for almost 6 weeks. And I thought that I would never walk again. And I dealt with excruciating pain that I can't even, I mean, it was like labor. I have two children. I mean, it was like labor times 10, never in my wildest imagining. And then I also had to take painkillers, which I didn't want to have to do. It was a process for me of really having to bear down. And when it was the first time in recovery that I really had to rely, and did I really believe that there was a higher power out there that loved me? Because if my higher power loved me, why was I going through this? This was deep core stuff that I had to go through. And I will tell you, there were times when I couldn't pray. I was in too much pain. But I will tell you, when I picked up the phone and I called you guys, you prayed for me. You prayed with me. You brought me abstinent meals. You told me that I could get through this. You told me other experiences that you had pain and that you had gotten through and that you would hold my hand and help me get through it. And you did. You did. You know, my first child, when she was born, she had something called a malrotation of the bowel. It's deadly. I had the doctor come to me when we took her to the hospital, said three things are going to happen. We're going to either fix this and put her guts. Basically, it means that in utero, all of her outsides, their intestines, all that were, all, I mean, they were all on the outside. They were supposed to be in her. They were outside of her in utero. And so they had to have emergency surgery. And she said, you know, she'll die, more than likely she'll die, or we can fix this, or we'll put her halfway back together and she'll have a colostomy bag for the rest of her life. Talk about needing help. You know, I pick up a phone and I call you guys and you show me the way. Does that mean I did it perfectly? No, I screamed, I yelled, you know what I mean? I didn't know what to do. And sometimes it's just a matter of surviving, but I did know, and you guys drained it into me, that there was nothing that I would go through that eating that food would make better. Because you see, by then, having worked the steps, the miracle of that personality transformation is that I'd been restored to sanity. That's the beauty of the program. Not only that that the food doesn't call me anymore, it doesn't call me because it doesn't have power over me anymore. Because I now know in my heart and in my head that it's not going to fix it, because I've been changed by the process of working these 12 steps. Because trust me, if it had been before program, that would have been my answer.
When you're going through these really rough times, because you don't have the food, you don't have the numbing. You know, the feelings are coming up and they're attacking you, right? So you're going through something and you have, how do you deal with self-defeating attitude, doing hurtful things to yourself? And I'm not talking necessarily about cutting on yourself, but your behavior towards yourself.
Well, we talk about honesty and integrity. My behavior is not always on target, right? So as long as I'm willing to tell someone about it, that behavior has a chance to go away, right? This, you're only as sick as your secrets. And I will tell you, the more I told people about things that I did wrong, the better I got about myself and not wanting to do those things that are destructive to myself. First of all, she told me one thing that I found incredibly valuable. She said, you know what? Your feelings, first off, are not fatal. I know you feel like they're going to kill you right now, but they're not fatal. They won't kill you. And they're not telling you the truth. Your feelings lie to you. And I can tell you from experience, that is absolutely the truth. My feelings, my reacting to feelings told me to do things that I know were not right. Might have been in hindsight. But it is really valuable for her to say to me, look, Amy, I know you feel like you're going to die right now or that your child may not get better, but I will tell you that there is hope regardless of what the outcome is and that your feelings right now are not going to kill you. You may feel like it. We'll help you feel them, okay? But you're not going to die. And I needed to understand that at very many different phases of my life so far about understanding that feelings do not tell me the truth. But every time I got through one of those incidences, abstinent, and trying on new behavior and start talking program to myself instead of listening to the bullshit in my head that my feelings are telling me are going on, I got better. It was like a little notch on the belt where I started to believe. I started to have hope. I started to understand about spirituality and God doing for me what I could not do for myself. So again, it's a process. I hope that helps.
We do have time for a few more questions, but I don't
absolutely.
We don't have any in the chat right now. So what is the first thing that you do with a new, you know, someone is brand new, walks in the door and comes to you and says, okay, I get it. My binge food is sweets, but I can't give up sweets. I can't do that. I can't give up all the sweets.
Well, you know, if this person is, it's very interesting. You know, I've had my fair share of love from the fellowship and my fair share of tough love in the fellowship, and I needed both. And I guess it was God's timing when I got each, right? Because when I had been in the rooms for almost 5 years and went through a plethora of sponsors, because I wasn't willing to do things like give up the sweets and things like that. I remember my first like real sponsor, when we started working on this food plan or whatever. And, you know, she kept reminding me, Amy, if your way is working so well, why are you here? I mean, love you, Amy, but I hate your disease. So the reality is all I can do is give you the instructions that I have that have worked for me. And all I can tell you, Amy, if you want to keep doing what you're doing, I can't stop you. You're welcome. The disease is happy to refund your misery. But if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, I can show you the way, but you have to be willing to take the action, you know, and those are things that I needed to hear. And she said, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get a food plan. You're going to get abstinent. We're going to work the steps. You're going to give service. I mean, she laid it out because she said, look, I don't want you to say, you know, for me to be your sponsor, that, you know, they talk about frothy emotional appeal, right? You know, this is what we're going to do. She said, I'm going to lay it out for you and you go and think about it. And if this is what you really want and you're willing to go to any length, then call me back and I will give you my left arm to help you recover. But you're going to have to make that choice, the choice I was talking to you about that I shared about earlier. If you're choosing, I'm not asking you to do it perfect, but step one is the only one we can do with 100%, right? Which is I'm powerless. Okay, show me the way, right? And so with a newcomer, that's what I do. I ask them, I tell them what I'm going to want to do. I'm going to want to do with them. I'm going to tell them how I'm going to lay it out. And then they have a choice. And you know what? I didn't have to understand it all to make that decision. Some of the stuff they asked me to do sounded crazy, but you know what? My way wasn't working and I wanted to die. So, okay, I'll try it.
Thank you. Amy, you mentioned your time in the program and life's transitions that came along. Can you share about empty nest transition and parts of your program that helped the most?
Oh my gosh, come on. Can you hand me the instruction manual? I don't have it. I'm just starting. Okay. My kids literally just started college and I am dealing with me and my husband and our relationship and how we're transitioning. And I'll be honest with you, it's scary, but it's also kind of exciting. But I wish I had great feedback for you. And I don't, because I'm going through it too, sister, or whoever's asking. I will tell you that nothing changes about my program. You know, there is a transition. But what gives me confidence, I guess, or hope, is that the anchors of my program and how I work my program and what I do for my program are rock solid and in place. You know what I mean? They're my anchors. They're my anchors through my day. I know what I'm going to do every day to work my program. And when I have that, it's like a security blanket. We're talking about moving. We're talking about selling our house. We're talking about having enough money to retire sooner rather than later. All that stuff is scary as shit. But I can tell you that I know tomorrow I'm going to get up. I'm going to get on my knees. I'm going to ask God for freedom from bondage of self and for another absent recovered day. I'm going to ask to be of maximum service in some way, shape, or form to the still suffering compulsive overeater. I'm going to take my sponsee calls. I'm probably going to go to a meeting virtually. I know what I'm going to do for the day. I don't know what's going to happen a month from now, but I do know what's going to happen tomorrow. And then I'm going to trust God for the results. The saying is, pray to God, row to shore, right? I'm going to row to shore. You know, that doesn't mean I don't plan with my husband. It doesn't mean I don't dream. That's the exciting part. And some of it going to be scary. Yeah, because I tell you what, I don't know one compulsive overeater out there that projects positively into the future. I'm still working on that one. It's always like, what's that saying when when an addict gets a flat tire on the highway, you know, a normal person calls AAA and the addict calls suicide prevention. Yeah, that's kind of like the way my MO is, right? But I've learned that I have other options now and I have a program that I can work. So I hope that helps.
Many people come to the program. A lot of them don't even do the 12 steps for a long time. Some start right and they do the 12 steps and some do them again every so often. Other people say, I do it every day through steps 10, 11, and 12. What is your opinion about repeating a full 12-step process?
Well, I primarily am living in steps 10, 11, and 12. And what I find is that, let's just say I have a behavior that, you know, the 10th step is not getting it done, right? I can't seem to stop doing it. Then quite often I will go back to do, and I do this with my sponsees because it's been done for me. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm just plagiarizing. We all plagiarize the hell out of each other, right? You know, it was passed down to me. I'm passing it along to someone else, you know? And so what I'll do is I'll go back to a fourth step because I'm going to do a fourth step on that particular issue because I just can't get free of it. Maybe it's a resentment that I've done a bazillion 10 steps on that has appeared out of nowhere on a certain issue, and I need to go a little deeper. So I'll go down to a fourth step. And if I still can't find freedom, then I'll do in-depth step work on step three. And maybe I'll go to the OA or the AA 12 and 12, and I'll do a delve into step three. Because usually, if it's something I won't let go of, there's a spiritual disconnect, right? There is a spiritual disconnect that I am unwilling to let go of. So I'll do different kinds of step work and have done different kinds of step work throughout my recovery. There have been times where I have felt, and I like to think it's my higher power guiding me, that I've just wanted to do the steps over again. That doesn't mean that my fourth step is like in depth like it was at the beginning. You know, I've done a number of different fourth steps, but I just feel a need for a refresher. And I always learn something new. Sometimes I'll do it with an AWOL group, or I'll do it with two or three people. We'll go through some, there's other supplemental literature out there that has stuff about the 12 steps. We'll go through that together. So I don't really have, you know, my feeling is go for it. As long as we're working the program, which is the steps, of course, then to me, I'm growing. And that's what I need to be doing, is growing in this program. So I don't really have a specific answer to that, except it's, yeah, I'm working all of them. And it kind of depends where I am and what I need, depending on how thorough the revisit of those steps are, if that makes sense. I hope that helps.
Yes, great. You mentioned you went through a number of sponsors in your beginning. How did you handle that? Did you end the relationships? Did they? And I know when I had a sponsor end our relationship, it devastated me. How do you handle that?
Again, it's a program of principles over personalities. And I think we all learn that the hard way. You know, I'm just as sick as in that. We're all sick trying to get well, right? It's not a bad person. There's not a bad sponsor out there. You know what I mean? There's not the best sponsor out there. You know, as soon as I put a sponsor on a pedestal, I'm in trouble. And that's my fault. You know, I'll remember my first sponsor. I put it on a pedestal. The first one when I was really working on recovery, okay, in 87. And I put her on a pedestal. And one day, I mean, I'm talking like one day out of the clear blue, she said to me, Amy, I'm really sorry. I don't want to work the program anymore. And I'm just going to do my own thing. I need you to get another sponsor. I wish you well. And I kid you not, I've never heard from her again. I've never seen her again. And I hope to God she's doing all right and she's okay. Because we haven't cornered the market on recovery, okay, folks? I mean, I know it works for me. And that's all I can say. And that was devastating to me because I thought for sure it was something I did. And it wasn't. It was just what she needed to do. I've had other sponsors who kindly dropped me. And it was good that they did because it hurt, but it helped me want to do something else, right? When they said to me, I love you, but I hate your disease. And I feel like me continuing to sponsor you is enabling your disease. I can't sponsor you anymore. That was incredibly hurtful. And you know what? I could have used any of that to identify out. You know, I could have identified out. And I'm not saying it didn't hurt, but they were right. And ultimately, I needed to hear those things again and again to finally get to the end of myself, you know, and say, I really need to work this program. We talk about honesty and integrity. By the time you're in OA for a while, you know what I mean? I knew the way this program worked. And people dropped me for the right reasons. When I was finally willing to admit, doesn't mean it didn't hurt my feelings. And sometimes I've had experiences with sponsors that were flat out wrong. And I had to work step work on it and really forgive, okay? Because things they said and did were wrong, frankly. And I know it now in my heart. I was blamed for something that was not my fault. And I was shamed for something I should not have been shamed for. But as I grow in recovery and I grow to understanding and self-care of myself, I start to understand how to co-collaborate in my own recovery, what works for me and what doesn't. I didn't do that back then in early recovery, but I can now. Part of long-term recovery is understanding that, intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me, right? One of the promises of the program. And there's things, like I said, people, we're all sick trying to get well. I don't know what was going on with that person in their lives when they said something that was hurtful to me. Not my business, but it is my business to deal with how that affected me. That's my job, my responsibility, to do the 10th step, to do the work around it, and then let go and forgive as I have been forgiven, right? Because trust me, I wasn't very nice many a time to those sponsors, many a time, nor was I honest, to be honest with you.
Well, Amy, you have been amazing. I feel like you have just put yourself out there, and I appreciate it so much.
Let's close with the OA promise. A moment of silence for those of us inside and outside of these rooms who still suffer. I put my hand in yours, and together we can do what we could never do alone. No longer is there a sense of hopelessness. No longer must we each depend upon our own unsteady willpower. We are all together now, reaching out our hands for a power and strength greater than ours. And as we join hands, we find love and understanding beyond our wildest dreams.